estamos renunciando, estoy renunciando justamente para que mis hermanas y hermanos.
On Sunday, in a televised announcement to the world, Bolivian President Evo Morales stepped down for what he called the good of the country after an audit of the election that put him in power noted some irregularities. The day of that announcement, a group of Bolivians in Kansas City gathered on the street outside of Union Station to celebrate, but they also wanted to deliver a message. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and one of the participants in that event is here now to explain it. Bernardo Jordan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
There are, of course, differing viewpoints out there in the world, but Evo Morales called the audit of the election that put him in power 3 weeks ago a coup. Is that how you see it?
Absolutely not. We believe that there were some irregularities, as the OAS audit showed, that where there was the election was fraudulent. So basically, the government party, I think, rigged the election so they could win.
And it sounds like, though, that your group's message is not about one candidate over the other. It's about something else entirely.
Correct. We are not affiliated to any political party. What we want is honesty. We want an honest and a clean election, which obviously, after the audit report from the OAS, you can confirm that that wasn't the case.
Where were you when you heard that Morales had stepped down? Can you tell me what it was like to hear this news and what kind of ran through your mind?
Wow. I was in my house with my wife and my son, and we basically didn't do anything that day because we were watching the news. We were watching the Bolivian channels. When that happened, it was joy. It was celebratory. We felt that the power of the people. You know, we as the people, we fought for something that we wanted, and it seemed that we accomplished it.
So you are part of a group that organized a pretty quick demonstration. In fact, your wife is the main organizer. What made you want to respond to what was happening in public in Kansas City, so far away from Bolivia?
So all of our families live there. You know, my parents, my siblings, my wife's siblings, everybody's there demonstrating. They are risking their lives for a belief. And it's very comfortable to be abroad and not do anything. So we said, hey, let's try to do something. Is there anything we can do from here? And through networking, through social media, we contacted several different groups, and then through them, we put something together.
When you say that your families are risking their lives, what can you explain why that is? What's at stake for them?
So far, there's been 5 people dead in the 20 days of protesting that we've had. But basically, one of the major items that happened on Sunday night after President Morales resigned, all of his followers went out on the streets and did a lot of vandalism. They burned hospitals. They burned houses. And basically, they just did a lot of scare of people. So people were defending their homes. People were defending their families. You know, my brother was, I have a picture of my brother yesterday sitting in the middle of the street defending my house, my family, my parents. It's insane.
Who came to the demonstration on Sunday and why? What were the different motivations that brought people out?
So at the time, the demonstration on Sunday was a celebratory demonstration saying, hey, President Morales resign. However, we had several other demonstrations where we wanted the international community to know about the fraud that the governmental party had done on the elections. And we basically were showing support to our people in Bolivia.
What is the story of how you came to the U.S.? Can you tell me a little bit about your own Bolivian roots and your journey coming here?
Sure. So I came here to go to UMKC. I grew up in Bolivia. I went there to high school, and then I came in 2002. And I've been here since.
What is your message for Kansas Cityans, specifically for people, as we've said, living far away from Bolivia, people who may not even have any understanding at all of who Evo Morales is, let alone having an opinion of him or his election? Is your message about him, or is it about something else?
It's about democracy. We live in probably the flagship of democracy. We live in a free country, and you know, we all strive for that. So, you know, through international support, such as organizations such as the OES or the IMF or the UN, we want countries to have what we have here in the US. We want to have freedom. We want to have democracy. We want to have access.
It's interesting to me that we're having this conversation the day before impeachment hearings officially begin here in the US.
It is. I agree. You know, I think we all have different points of view about different things. And, you know, each person, I think, does what they believe it's better or correct.
I understand that part of your group's message this past Sunday actually did have to do with voting in whatever democracy you are a part of, if you're part of a democracy, the importance of protecting your vote and using it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. So basically, all the demonstrations for these past 20 days were basically to respect our vote. We went and voted on October 20th. But then after about that night, October 20th, about 24 hours, the voting count basically stopped. And suddenly, even though everything was heading in the direction that there was going to be a very close from the first to the second, suddenly something changed and they announced that the president was going to be winning again. So as a result, we saw that the rigged election, and therefore we want to vote again. We want something that's honest and real, and we want our vote to be heard and respected.
And there's lots of reporting on this at npr.org if anyone wants to look into what's been written about it and reported, if you haven't heard that on the air. But Bernardo, before we go, just there is a sizable Bolivian community in Kansas City, and that's part of what this demonstration kind of reveals. It's a very making public of a whole community, a large community, one that may have differing political beliefs, but yes, a large community.
Yes, I think we have about 150 to 200 people here in Kansas City. We're still in the process of gathering each other's information. There is a big community that typically attends KU. So KU has a lot of Bolivian people over there.
Are you feeling like a minority at UMKC with your brethren at KU?
No, not at all. Not at all. I think, you know, the more Bolivians we can have here in Kansas City, the better for me. So,
Bernardo Jordan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bernardo is part of a group of Bolivians in Kansas City who gathered at Union Station this past Sunday in response to the news that Bolivian President Evo Morales had stepped down. Up next, someone who's been working behind the scenes in Kansas City politics takes a new direction. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're going to talk with Jeff Jolly. A lot of Kansas Cityans got to know him on the campaign trail during a tight race for a seat on city council, a seat that was ultimately won by his opponent, Eric Bunch. The campaign was a big moment for Jeff Jolly, who had worked quietly behind the scenes in politics in important roles in politics for a long time, most notably as district director and general counsel to Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver. At the same time, Jeff spent decades serving as a firefighter, and now as he moves into a new role in the community, he's leaving politics and firefighting behind. We're going to hear the story of how he's juggled those two passions all this time. Jeff Jolly, it is so nice to have you here.
Thanks, Gina. Pleasure to be here.
First off, what is your new gig? We'll get the backstory in a minute.
So I've been fortunate to be offered the position as the executive director for LISC, which is the Local Initiative Support Corporation. We're based out of New York. But I'm coordinating the Kansas City office. We have 36 offices nationwide.
What does LISC do?
So LISC invests in communities to help lift up, make more vibrant, prosperous communities. We say that our mission is to build relationships with our partners and neighborhoods to build resilient and inclusive communities of opportunity. And so we focus our work primarily in low, moderate income neighborhoods on both sides of the state line. And it's a challenge that I'm looking forward to working on.
So, speaking of resilience, losing an election is not fun. I have never run for office, but I feel confident in that. So I will not make you relive that experience, except to say the campaign itself seems to have been this moment of you, for you, of stepping out from behind the scenes. You were putting your name out there And not everyone knew you already, but you have been this force in local politics for a while. Can you take me back to the beginning of your career in politics? Where did it get started?
Wow. Sure. I started in 1994 as a volunteer on Alan Wheat's Senate campaign. It was a requirement for a class I was taking in high school.
We were actually classmates in high school.
We were. Dr. Barbara Judd gave the assignment. And she didn't care whether you worked for a Democrat or a Republican. She was just interested in helping to encourage people get involved in their community. And so I went to the local Westport office and volunteered for Alan Wheat. He ultimately lost that race to John Ashcroft. But that then led to opportunities. I was offered an internship in Congresswoman Karen McCarthy's office, who had replaced him in the House of Representatives.
So I just want to say, in 1994, you were in high school. This
I
is
was.
All you're offered your next internship. You're in high school.
Well, so the internship happened. I was in college by the point in
okay,
that happened.
Fair enough.
But I ended up working for Karen for almost 6-7 years, transitioning from the internship onto her campaign and working on her campaigns in 2000, 2002, 98, 2000, 2002.
It seems like you caught the bug for politics right away.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was interested in using politics as a way of making change, positive change in the community. And I was happy to play, you know, a minor supporting role behind the scenes for both Karen and then for Congressman Cleaver.
Yeah, you have had a long-standing relationship with the Cleaver administration. I mean, going back to when I was working on the Walt Bodine show,
yeah.
You were the guy who accompanied him to the station when he'd
yeah.
come in. Tell me about that relationship, how it developed and evolved.
Well, so I was finishing up my law school career and had kind of made the decision that I was going to probably move into a career away from political campaigns, which tend to be cyclical. And Karen had announced that she would be retiring in 2004, and some mutual friends of ours approached me and said, would you be interested in helping with Congressman Cleaver's campaign? And I came back and met with him. And was instantly impressed with him. I had only briefly known him as Mayor Cleaver. I said, "Well, let me help you over the next 6 months, kind of get elected."
Help how?
Well, so I was offered a position as the campaign coordinator. So I oversaw the day-to-day operations of the campaign staff, our volunteers, the scheduling.
Nuts and bolts, it sounds like.
It was a lot of day-to-day operations, and it was a great team. And it was fun to see the community really rally. His church, St. James United Methodist Church, provided a number of volunteers and helped out. And it was fortunate for me to be able to have that exposure. And I ended up, he offered me the position as district director.
Yeah, what does a district director do?
So again, kind of coordinates the staff. We had a staff of about 10 here in the district. We had 3 offices, Kansas City, Independence, and Higginsville, Missouri, ultimately.
So then if he's off in D.C., you guys are here.
Right. So I would represent him at community meetings often, civic meetings, neighborhood meetings, and then coordinate the team here who's also representing him while he's in Washington.
You must have learned a lot about Kansas City, being that person who is hearing from the citizens on behalf of a congressman.
Yeah, I think so. I think I was fortunately exposed to a lot in our community, but also learned a lot from him. I mean, he's somebody who went through the civil rights era, had been a part of the movement, ultimately came here from Texas to start the SCLC chapter, and really, for me, an opportunity to be exposed to a different part of our community and a different experience, life experiences than what I had had. And so trying to take some of that wisdom and knowledge and put it to work in my new role.
Talk to me a little bit more about that people coming from different life experiences and what that was like for you. Is there a moment that you remember where you were just like, wow, my eyes have been opened to something that hadn't been within my ability to imagine before?
I mean, there are a number of experiences. I mean, I can remember being accused during the campaign on a local blog of being the token white guy at Urban Core events. And frankly, I wore that with a badge of honor. I think it's important for all of us to be exposed to a diversity of cultures and communities. And so I was happy to have the opportunity to do that under the congressman.
You were also general counsel.
Yes.
What does general counsel do?
So
I'm getting a little civics 101 while interviewing you.
Sure. So that was as a result of having the law degree. And ultimately, I would review some of our legislation and ensure that we were compliant with the House ethics and the federal government's ethics guidelines are robust and making sure we were compliant at all times.
Where does fighting fires enter this equation? Because, I mean, we haven't really addressed this, but you've been a firefighter throughout this exact same period in your life.
Yeah.
And I understand you were inspired to do that on September 11th, 2001.
Yeah. I was in law school when September 11th happened. I was going to the University of Missouri in Columbia, go Tigers. And, you know, the nation stopped moving, you know, for weeks there. There was a lot of focus around there's a FEMA search and rescue team that's based in Columbia, Missouri Task Force One. And they were immediately activated and deployed to New York that day to help start searching at the World Trade Center. And so I went into their offices a few weeks upon their return to ask how to join that FEMA team. I was so moved by these men and women who just walked away from their jobs with about 2 hours notice and flew to New York to help out. So I went into their offices and said, you know, I'd love to join this FEMA team. And they said, well, what do you do? I said, oh, I'm a law student at Mizzou, thinking that carried some weight with it. And they kind of chuckled and said, well, we don't need any law students. Thank you very much. And showed me the door. So I hesitated and said, well, what profession are most of these men and women? And they said, most of them are firefighters or fire-based personnel. And I said, great, give me an application to be a firefighter then.
So stop me. I want to stop you here because what was it that motivated you? What was it that appealed to you about being one of those men and women? And that felt important to you about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all have an obligation to leave our community and this world better than we found it. And the fact that these individuals selflessly gave their time and, you know, obviously there was a tremendous loss of life in New York and people were heartbroken. And to watch these individuals say, we'll shoulder the burden, stand alongside FDNY and NYPD and others to try and search for the brothers and sisters that have been lost was just moving to me. And I wanted to be in a position where, should the need arise in the future, that I was able to do my part to give back to our community.
So you asked for an application right then and there?
I did, yeah. And so I applied and ultimately was accepted a couple months later and became initially a volunteer firefighter. And then joined the FEMA Urban Search and Rescue Team a few months after that.
So you have described so far the life trajectory of a guy who's in law school, who volunteers, who is an intern for political campaigns.
Right.
And forgive whatever stereotypes I have of the skills and strengths that a person cultivates in that activity, and then the very different, what I perceive to be a very different set of skills and strengths and demands on a firefighter. I'm just wondering what those early days of training to be a firefighter might have felt like to you.
I mean, it was certainly different. I was fortunate that my uncle outside of St. Louis had been a firefighter his entire life career. And so I had some exposure to first responders in my family, some law enforcement in the family as well. But it was definitely different. You have to, once you get past that initial claustrophobia and, you know, understand that the training that you're receiving will help protect you and the people around you. It can be very rewarding.
I have a brother-in-law who was a firefighter for a while, and I remember his first day on the job that he was like, it was amazing. You kick in people's doors, you like hose it down, you turn over their furniture, and then they thank you.
You're right. Yeah. I mean, I tell people firefighters are in and out of people's lives in 30 minutes typically, whether it's at a car wreck or at a house fire or somebody's not feeling well and they've called for medical assistance. And oftentimes they don't know who you are. They don't know your name. Your job is to make them feel better and hopefully leave them in a better situation. And then you go back to work and get ready for the next call. And, you know, a good day, nobody calls, ideally. But unfortunately, in the reality, that's not the world we live in. And so, you know, I was happy to play a role. My favorite memories are, frankly, the opportunities to engage with some of the kids. We played basketball with kids on the street. We'd interact with our friends who we saw every shift at the grocery store, at the local, you know, gas station, Quick Trip.
Kids love fire trucks.
They do. They do. And my kids in particular love them. And frankly, when I made the decision to leave the fire service, my girls, their main question was, who's going to be able to bring a fire truck to the school? I said, well, I'm pretty sure we can still get one there.
Tell me about what your journey as a firefighter has taught you.
Well, I think I would say it opened my eyes to some of the real life struggles that people are facing. So typically the individuals who call 911 are folks who are facing some sort of emergent need. So, you know, you go in and their two-year-old is having trouble breathing. And you ask about their inhaler. Well, their inhaler is out because they haven't had the funds to refill it. And so they had to make a decision. Do I pay rent this month or do I refill my kid's inhaler and risk losing their shelter? And when you start to understand kind of that really on the street level issues that individuals are facing, you start to appreciate how much need there is in the community and how much opportunity there is to utilize what I perceived as some of my relationships and experiences in the political world to bridge that divide from what I saw kind of on the street.
I am curious, with so much public discourse surrounding the role of police officers and the relationships between police officers and communities becoming sort of visibly controversial, I am wondering, I've heard this refrain, firefighters, those are the ones who really help you. Did you feel like there was an increased pressure on firefighters in a way during this time?
Oh, I wouldn't say an increased pressure. I think firefighters are fortunate in that we're not in a situation where we're having to make the decision to arrest somebody's uncle or their father or their mother. And so, you know, just the dynamics of the role we play in the community is such that it allows for firefighters to be viewed in maybe a more friendly light. But I can tell you that my experience in Kansas City was that many of the first responders, Kansas City police officers, in fact, I tweeted about one the other day, two of them, who were helping a homeless gentleman in a wheelchair. You know, I think a lot of their humanity goes unnoticed as a result of some of the more high-profile kind of controversies around it. But many of the officers I know are out there just trying to do good and help people as well.
So you've mentioned your daughters.
Yeah.
That you're also a parent, and it sounds like, additionally, a pretty involved member of your community, I think, in Kansas City's historic Northeast.
Yeah.
I am having a very hard time understanding how anyone could possibly be a politician and firefighter and still have any energy left for being a person.
I guess I would say I was blessed to have a very supportive family. My wife is a public school teacher here in Kansas City, and so she had also been in politics herself. We met during the campaign season. She had worked for Senator Claire McCaskill and then ultimately made the decision to leave the senator's office to become a public school teacher. And so I think that I'm fortunate to have a partner at home who has kind of the same passion for giving back into our community.
Yeah, I do want to get to the heart of really like where your motivation comes from. Is there some like formative story in your childhood or some thread in your family? Because the impulse for service seems sort of maybe beyond the ordinary.
Well, I don't know if it is beyond the ordinary. I think people give back to their communities in different ways. I think mine was maybe a little more high profile, but you know, I would say my maternal grandfather had been a mechanic for most of his life and was the type of individual, this was before cell phones, so he would stop as a child, you know, every time we were in the car, he would stop to help somebody whose car had broken down, or if somebody was walking on the side of the road, he was the guy who would stop and offer him a ride. And so, you know, I think just as a child, watching an adult treat other people with respect and not worry about what their political political beliefs were or who they were or where they came from. He treated everyone the same. He had been a United States Marine and earlier in his life. And I just, I think that I'm trying to emulate that as best I can.
But how have you juggled the whole like politician firefighter thing? I'm imagining like a Clark Kent-esque like switcheroo in a phone booth real quick type situation.
So I joke that I had two uniforms, either a suit or a firefighter's uniform. But I worked every third day as a firefighter. And most firefighters in our community work second jobs. I would say many of them are not behind a desk. So, you know, they might be more helping to remove snow or landscaping, some other work with your hands. I tended to think that I had it easy because I went and would then sit behind a desk or in front of a computer and be able to go out and talk about what the congressman wanted and relay to him what the community was asking for was pretty rewarding work. So
now you're going to have one job.
Yeah.
Tell me about some projects that you're thinking about that have you feeling energized in your new role at LISC.
So I'm very excited about the team we've got here in Kansas City and nationally. Our focus is going to be on affordable housing, financial stability, and then economic development. Again, kind of focused on both sides of the state line in those low, moderate income neighborhoods. I think the community you've seen, both the current mayor in Kansas City, Missouri, and the city council talking a lot about affordable housing. And so I think where LISC is able to provide some assistance is both leverage our relationships nationally with banks and with our other 35 offices and say, what are our experiences in creating affordable housing in some of those communities, have best practices, and really put them to work here in Kansas City.
Jeff Jolly, thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I appreciate it.
Jeff is the new executive director of LISC in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman, and when KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear the next episode of My Fellow Kansans. This time, the question is, can a town shrink in population and still be okay? Why some Kansans are excited by an idea called shrinking smart, coming up next. I'm Gina Kaufman, this is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're going to listen to episode 3 of the new season of My Fellow Kansans, a podcast that comes to us from our friends in the Kansas News Service. This season is an investigation of whether the existential angst surrounding the decline of rural Kansas is really as simple and dismal as it seems. Could something more complicated be going on there? Host and native Kansan Jim McLean is on a mission to find out. Let's hear episode 3 right now.
Look at your pretty shirt. Happy. Are you happy today?
Okay, so out here we've got two separate play areas sectioned off, one for the younger infants and then one for the older kids.
Don't let that English accent throw you. That's Phillips County, Kansas Economic Development Director Nick Pools. He got the job after following his wife back to her native Kansas. I'm tagging along on a tour of Phillipsburg's new child care center. Visitors from dozens of other small Kansas towns are also in tow. They've come to learn about how this town of 2,500 marshaled the resources to meet what is clearly an urgent need throughout rural Kansas, including places like Leota, where Tammy Simons is from.
We only have one home daycare provider that is licensed by the state of Kansas. We have no group daycare homes. We have no child care centers. So our parents who need to work, they have nowhere for their kids to go. And that also limits our economic development in our community because we can't attract teachers, we can't attract doctors, we can't attract the people that we need to keep our community running.
So that's why it's urgent.
That's why it's urgent.
Phillipsburg Pools says felt the same urgency.
It was a no-brainer. As a recruitment thing, as a necessity to the community quality of life, we had to do a project like this.
A no-brainer, something community leaders deemed essential to the town's survival, which hinges in part on its ability to attract younger workers looking for a place to raise their families. That thinking, that willingness to risk new ideas, to take action, separates towns resigned to their death from those that can adapt and thrive, even as they get smaller. Researchers have a name for it. They call it shrinking smart.
Shrink smart communities are those communities that saw faster than average declines in population, but also had above average gains in quality of life.
I'm Jim McLean, and this is My Fellow Kansans, a podcast from the Kansas News Service. In this episode, we'll talk to social scientists working on a kind of survival blueprint for rural communities, and to people in those small towns grasping for a lifeline. Towns that don't have the power to reverse the economic and social trends driving people away, but towns that aren't altogether powerless, at least according to the research.
Some of these places have a very thriving quality of life despite shrinking populations. They're great places to live. People are happy in their communities. They have top-notch services for children, good medical services, even though they're small and they're shrinking.
Meet Dave Peters. He's a professor at Iowa State University and part of the team working on that survival blueprint.
I do research on population demographics and rural social change. I teach classes in rural sociology and rural culture. And I also have an extension appointment where I go out into Iowa communities and help them address these issues of depopulation and change in their communities.
Now, was it that work that led you to coin the term shrinking smart?
Yeah. When I would go into these communities, you would clearly see something was subjectively different, even though they had the same population, same level of income, same level of economic development. You could tell when you walked into certain towns there was this vitality, where in other towns it was absent. And so this research team I'm working with kind of coalesced on this concept called smart shrinkage. Even though these communities had shrinking populations, that didn't mean they were declining towns.
Shrinking but not declining. That's not just a rhetorical distinction. It means there's something really different going on in those towns, something relatively rare. So far, just 7 of the 99 Iowa communities studied by Peters and his team have earned the Shrinking Smart designation, including a few that my KCUR colleague Frank Morris visited last year for a story he did for NPR, a story that starts in a noisy factory.
Business is booming here at Sukup Manufacturing in Sheffield, Iowa. They make those big round steel bins you see dotting the grain belt. Charles Sukup says he's hiring about as fast as he can and already employs close to 700 people in this town of just over 1,100.
Well, I guess our philosophy is you bloom where you're planted.
But Sukup's dedication to Sheffield hasn't been enough to shield it from the larger social and economic headwinds buffeting small towns.
The big picture for all rural communities that don't have a connection to a growing metro area is that they are going to get smaller over time.
Kimberly Zarikor teaches at Iowa State University and argues that little towns should stop beating themselves up for losing population and instead focus on making life better for the residents they still have.
We call this the Shrink Smart Project.
It's an idea that dawned on Zarikor when she studied in a city in the Czech Republic, one that saw its local coal and steel industry collapse 30 years ago.
Ostrava is a place that's shrinking, losing people, but it's still a place that people love to live and are very loyal to. And it's also a place that outsiders look at and think, I don't want to be there.
Sounds like any number of small American towns, right? Zarikor says the difference is that Ostrava is embracing the idea that it can shrink and still improve. Zarikor and her colleague at Iowa State, Dave Peters, want to bring that paradigm shift to rural America. Peters says they're conducting surveys to figure out how it is that some remote rural towns manage to make life better for their residents, even as their populations drain away.
So Sac City is probably one of our best examples of Shrink Smart in that the quality of the services, the quality of the government, the quality of the community, it's phenomenal.
That's Sac City, Iowa. Population 2,200 and falling. It's 7 a.m., and members of the Sac City Community Foundation are discussing possible projects. $2,500 to build a bike path, maybe chipping in for a marketing campaign. Board member Steve Irwin says that while Sac City wants to grow, it's quality of life that comes first.
It's more about how the people feel about their towns. Are they happy? Do they have a sense of community? Do they have the essentials of life? Do they have health care and recreation?
Smaller than most cities' tiniest suburb, Sac City boasts a hospital, a nice rec center, two pools, schools, a library, robust daycare, even a roadside attraction, the world's largest popcorn ball, a confection that weighs more than 4.5 tons. This in a town that's lost a big chunk of its economic base and a third of its population since the 1980s. Irwin says the secret sauce here is people, super involved citizens, willing to work together for the good of the town.
Lots of things factor into that shrinking smart distinction. But when I talked to Peters, he said it really comes down to how towns are wired.
In rural sociology, you know, we talk about these different sets of infrastructure. We have the economic infrastructure, we have the built infrastructure, and those are important. But most towns have some semblance of economic or built infrastructure. Really, what was variable was what we call the social infrastructure.
Rural communities might be an exception. But most towns are home to a mix of people, black, white, brown, rich and poor, old and young, and in between. But in towns that are shrinking smartly, those differences are bridged. Lives are woven together. The towns have leaders, some elected and some who just step forward, willing to take chances and forgive each other's mistakes. But in what Peters calls withering communities, a far more common example, people remain divided along those class, income, and racial lines. And they leave the heavy lifting to politicians, who they also tend to blame when things go south.
We kind of combine these together, sort of trying of new ideas, focus on process, and acceptance of failure kind of is one and the same. So in these seven shrink smart towns, you know, oddball ideas get discussed. People kind of lay cards on the table and say, this is what I was thinking about. People talk about it. If it seems like a good idea, they'll move forward. If people don't think it's a good idea, you know, they move on to something else, and there's no animosity. In these declining, or these withering towns, we like to call them, once there's a failed project, the community turns nasty. People that were involved in that project are stigmatized, and then, of course, nobody wants to take the risk of trying to do anything.
What other indicators are there of this cohesiveness and this ability to look toward the future with some degree of optimism and determination? For instance, I'm thinking, you might look back over a community's history of school bond issues or mm-hmm. whether or not they're willing to tax themselves to keep the hospital open, those kinds of things. Are those also indicators of a community that is paying attention to the right things?
We have some what we call common themes or common threads that we think are symbolic of this progressiveness. One is local giving. So you talked about cities, you know, passing municipal infrastructure bonds to improve the hospital or improve the streets or broadband is now talked about a lot. But what we found in these shrink smart towns is that it's really local giving. There was one town of 500 in the northern part of Iowa that had four community foundations with assets of nearly $750,000. A town of 500 people was able to raise that amount. And so it was community groups that identified the priorities, identified the needs, built the coalitions of people, and really provided a large amount of the funding to implement these projects. It wasn't led by local government, which was surprising to us. You know, oftentimes government programs come with strings attached. And so if all you're offered is broadband funds or housing development funds or to improve your roads or wastewater and treatment systems, and really the need is daycare, you know, what do you do? That's not addressing that community's problems.
That brings us back to Nick Pools and the story of how Phillipsburg found a way to meet that urgent need for quality childcare.
So we did a strategic planning initiative about 5 years ago, and that was identified as one of the main priorities of what the community would like. And in talking with a lot of the business managers and CEOs of local companies, recruitment was an issue as well. They could have a really great candidate come to the community. to interview for a good position, one of the first questions they ask is, what's the availability of daycare in your community?
Tired of not having a good answer to that question, people rolled up their sleeves and got to work. High schoolers, Rotary Club members, and others. They gutted, then renovated an old convenience store. They wrestled with red tape to meet state licensing rules. And they hustled up some grant money from a foundation dedicated to enlivening communities in Northwest Kansas.
We serve 26 counties in Northwest Kansas. So if you start in Saline County and go north to Nebraska and west to Colorado, that's our quarter of the state.
That's Betsy Waring. She guides grant making for the Dane Hansen Foundation. Located in tiny Logan, Kansas, it supports community projects throughout the region to the tune of $20 million a year.
So our mission is to improve the quality of life for the communities and the people in Northwest Kansas. That's our mission, and we look at issues such as, you know, population decline and economic development and quality of life. And we make grants in the areas of education and arts and culture and just a variety of things.
Remember what Dave Peters said about the importance of local giving in shrinking smart communities. Well, this is a case in point, because in addition to its own grant making, the Hansen Foundation is helping to sustain a network of community foundations. Businesses like Nextech also play a role. It grew from a small rural telephone provider into a regional communications powerhouse. It's got a stake in keeping its market strong, so it works with the foundation on a paid internship program. And that program is aimed at slowing the steady exodus of young people. The company asked its customers to help out, to round up their monthly bills to the next dollar, to pitch in on the costs of the internships. And some 16,000 of those customers said sure.
So our goal is really youth retention. So we want to give...
Jackie Beckman works for Nextech and runs the internship program. The idea, she says, is to help young people see rural Kansas in a different light.
We're hoping that they'll be able to experience all that their community offers, not only with one particular business, but they have opportunities for networking, skill development. So, you know, if you're a high school student and this may be your first opportunity to understand what's available in your hometown.
So the point is, you're planting a seed and suggesting to them that no... they have options that maybe they didn't know they had.
Exactly, yeah. I'll use myself as an example. When I graduated from high school, I received luggage. So, you know, we've been in this habit of telling people, hey, there really isn't anything here for you. You need to go out and get your education and go to an urban area. So one of the things that our organization is trying to accomplish through this program is also a culture shift of being able to express to other community business owners, to the schools, and to parents and grandparents that there are a lot of opportunities. We just need to be talking about it.
I got to go on a road trip to Dodge City. That's where the Southwest Kansas Library System is located, and we got to visit.
It's graduation day, and with parents and sponsors looking on, several of this year's interns are giving presentations about what they did over the summer.
And we toured the train station there, so that was just a fun day. And then just an overview, it was just a really cool experience. It was my first, like, real job, so I just got to see how business works and so much more. So at the end, and I just want to thank you all for this experience. It was awesome.
Beckman can't yet document the program's effectiveness with hard numbers. But in 8 years, it's grown from 4 to 84 participants. And my conversations with several of this year's crop convinced me that it's working as intended, to change perceptions.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Before this internship, I probably would have said that I never would come back to Hayes, my hometown, ever again. But after this internship, I really learned that Hayes has a lot to offer, especially with the arts.
I think it's just kind of society gives us that idea that if we're smart, we need to go somewhere else, that there aren't jobs for us around here. Which isn't true, because, like, we're seeing through
it. I want to come back to Phillips County to work.
So what do you think the chances are that you'll go off to medical school in some big metropolitan area and change your mind about coming back here?
Oh, I don't think I'll change my mind. I just don't think I could leave this town.
Participating businesses also seem to be profiting, often getting more than they bargained for.
Our intern this year was Ross Cole. He is a student that just graduated from Long Island, Kansas. He was absolutely fantastic. In fact, it was hard to keep up with him. We would assign him a task which we thought would take him 3 or 4 days, and he'd get it done in 6 hours.
I learned more about it, coincidentally, with an email I'd received from Rachel. And it was like, wow, if I was going to have somebody, boy, this would be somebody I'd like to have, because I knew what her capabilities and standards would be. And it was just too good to pass up.
The Shrinking Smart research team hasn't studied communities outside of Iowa, so I can't point to any place in Kansas and say that's a town that's shrinking smartly. But I can say that my travels across the state have taken me to communities that seem to have at least some of the characteristics identified by Peters and his team. Phillipsburg is one of them. Beloit, Cortland, and Clyde also come to mind. Places where people are stepping up to start businesses and lead projects, big and small, to improve the quality of life for themselves and their neighbors. My Kansas News Service colleague Stephen Vasaha came across an example of that in Moran, a town of about 500 in southeast Kansas. People there didn't have a place to work out, so with a few leading the way, they pushed for one. And the gym they built is sparsely equipped and definitely not fancy. But as Stephen reported, people are using it to connect and get healthier.
Private health clubs are rare in rural Kansas. There just aren't enough gym rats to make a profit. And building and maintaining public rec centers requires the kind of money many small towns just don't have. But in 2017, the folks in Moran came up with a novel solution. A council member remembered their failed gas station turned failed steakhouse turned storage space and thought, what about a gym?
Right here, where the bench press is, this would be where your counter, you'd come up and pay for your gas or your candy bar or your pop.
Retiree Larry Ross helped convert the old filling station into a small fitness center. No personal trainers or basketball court, but for $10 a month, locals get a key fob and access to the building's bench press, elliptical machine, and other equipment. Ross says the same things that make the place ideal for a gas station make it great for a gym. The big windows and a spot on the highway give him a great view of a new wind farm going up.
Front row view, absolutely. Couldn't have got better seats if you was in one of those big high-priced boxes in the stadium, you know?
School psychologist LaVon Foster says what's more important than the view is the convenience. She says working out at the center has made her healthier than she's been in a long time.
Yes, I've, you know, lost, I don't know, what is it, 26 pounds? So I'm doing pretty good.
The Shrinking Smart research, Peters says, shows that investing in people projects, like gyms fashioned out of old gas stations and convenience stores turned into daycare centers, pays bigger dividends than industrial parks and tax incentives, even if the objective is to recruit new businesses.
You know, the common refrain from these communities that were not very progressive is that their solution to this is if only we could get a manufacturing plant to come in and hire 150 jobs. Well, there's 10,000 towns with the exact same strategy. What we're telling small towns is that if you can enhance that quality of life, if you can enhance the way you make decisions and the way your community comes together to address decisions, that positions you better to go after a new firm. The one thing that might be distinguishing when that company comes in is that they see how progressive your town is, how they're open to change, they're looking to move forward, that becomes infectious.
Still, some basic things, brick-and-mortar things, also matter. Good schools, decent housing, high-speed internet, a restaurant or two, and a main street lined with something other than dusty antique shops. But at or near the top of the things that matter list is healthcare, and sustaining that life-and-death service is a challenge for a growing number of communities in rural Kansas.
Our rural communities are challenged, and because of that, our small hospitals are challenged as well.
A look at efforts to save rural healthcare by rethinking it. That's next time on My Fellow Kansans.
And we will hear that next installment a week from today on Central Standard. If you are enjoying the podcast My Fellow Kansans, which we've been listening to this morning, they're having a live event at the Johnson County Library tomorrow night. It's at 6:30 p.m. and you can get all the details at kcur.org kcur.org/Kansans. That's kcur.org/Kansans. And thanks to our partners at the Kansas News Service for this weekly listen. We're really proud to get to share this podcast with you. You can listen to anything that's been on Central Standard today at kcur.org/Central Standard. That is where we keep all of our past shows. And while you're there, you can sign up to have them sent right to you like a podcast. kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow on this show, college athletes and new NCAA regulations around profiting financially from their own brands. That's tomorrow at 10. Don't miss that discussion. And you can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST, and I'm at Gina KCUR. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next here on KCUR, so stay tuned.